Conversations with Friends is a new series.
A series within a series.
Creative conversations between writer friends.
We were blown away by the calibre of the pitches we received from established, mid-career, debut and emerging writers.
From those writing poetry, fiction, non-fiction, plays, newsletters and PhDs.
Conversations to get you through these strange COVID days and beyond.
Sit back, stay home and enjoy.
Our first conversation with friends is between two Melbourne writers, Twee On and Nick Gadd. Twee On is a poet and arts journalist and the author of Turbulence, a poetry collection recently released by the University of Western Australia Press.
Nick Gadd is the author of two novels, Death of a Typographer and Ghost Lines. He has also written many essays, mostly about place, Melbourne, and psychogeography. He lives in Yarraville.
We're Catherine, very excited.
This is so exciting. This is the first one that we actually heard. And these two really love words.
Which is sort of perfect for this audience. I think everyone in the writing world is a bit of a word fan.
And then these two in particular. I love that line that Twee said that she finds words sexy. And, you know, maybe this is what we need right now, sexy words when we cannot touch anything or anyone.
Her poetry collection has quite a bit about her experiences dating. And I must admit, in the context of words, I often think it's lucky that Carney and I met in person, because if we met online, it would never have happened. He would have misplaced an apostrophe and I would have been extremely snobby about it.
Oh my gosh, that's so true. And you know, that has just made me think about the very first text messages I received from my darling husband, which were all in caps all the time, like every single one of them that I received. And I took that as being like this very full-on kind of assertive romancing of me, but I think that he just always wrote in caps. Oh dear.
And so these guys love words even to the level of font.
Yes. Now, I have to admit, I have not yet got a copy of Nick Gadd's book, but he talks about what it looks like.
Have you seen the picture of the cover?
Yes.
It's a great cover. It's one of those covers that you think, oh, God, that's perfection for the story within. I would actually like Nick to write a book on typography. But the only other person I've ever heard speak about typography is, have you heard Steve Jobs' Stanford commencement address?
No, I have not.
It's really good. I'll link in the show notes. It's really, really good. But okay. He talks about when he was in college, I don't think he went to many classes, but he ended up sitting in on a typography class that I don't think he was even enrolled in. But he talked about how when he started up Mac, the fact that he'd done this typography class was really important, and he wanted the Mac to have all these different sort of types and fonts and all the rest of it. And Windows essentially copied Mac. And that's really the reason that we have all the type fonts we have in Word. Yeah.
I love that. I did
really
not know
good.
That. Okay, I look forward to reading that link. I really liked the idea that Twee talks about as well of the poetic diary. She kind of refers to her poetry collection as a poetic diary. And I was thinking maybe there's lots of people right now telling us that we should be keeping journals and recording what's happening at this time, and that maybe the idea of a poetic diary is a kind of a less full-on way of doing that, if you're just writing down some little poetic lines at the moment, or lines of poetry to record.
Is another link I will link people to. There is a great group that's just started on Facebook called Corona Chorus, and it's basically people's coronavirus-related poetry. It's very good.
Love that.
I feel like the most achievable poem is the haiku.
It is the haiku. So yeah. My darling friend Zana Freilon started, I don't know if she's kept this up yet, doing a haiku a day on Instagram, just handwriting it out, whatever you're doing to try and get through self-isolation. So that's potentially people might like to join in that as well.
Good one. Let's get listening. This is our very first Conversations with Friends.
Thank you. Hello, everybody. My name is Tuyan. I'm here and I'm going to be talking with Nick. I've written a book called Turbulence. It's a collection of poetry and it's all about love and loss and disappointment and desire and dating and hope. It's about the modern condition, really, contained in short, sharp bursts of emotion.
I'm Nick Gadd and I've written the book called Death of a Typographer, which is a mystery novel about fonts and typography.
And we're both total word nerds.
Have you always been a word nerd?
As far as I can remember, I've always been a word nerd, as long as I have read, really. I mean, I've been a voracious reader ever since probably grade 3 or something like that. And I was one of those kids forever in the library. I just found it a wondrous place. And I think that love of words and reading and alternate universes never really left me. I never really came from a bookish background, so I think it was just another means of escape.
Yes.
How about you, Nick?
I did grow up in quite a bookish kind of house, yeah, and I was always, but I was the youngest child in my family, and so I was always escaping into books from a very early age. Yes, and I suppose I've always been fascinated by words and language in different forms. But your poetry is quite unusual in that it's full of these kind of references to language, not just punctuation, but grammar, typography. There's a poem about invisible ink and even Scrabble, you know. What was it that made you think that you could use this fascination with language for poetry?
I just find language really sexy. I know when people think of sex, they think of food and, you know, wine and all of that type of thing. I find language incredibly sexy. So I also did I went to uni and did a honors degree majoring in English literature, but my minor was in linguistics. So I have been long interested in the sort of the building blocks of language, not just actual words themselves, but all the little connecting bits in between. So that, you know, includes like punctuation and just I'm just fascinated. And, you know, just that's why I have like poems in this collection called Verb and Semicolon and Scrabble, because I'm just completely endlessly fascinated by language. And typography, I mean, were you always interested in fonts, Nick, or is that just some sort of just sort of crept up on you, this book?
I became interested in fonts and typography through my friendship with a guy called Stephen Banham, who's a type designer, a graphic designer and a writer, and we've been friends for years. And Stephen is an expert on type. And over the years, we've had many conversations about fonts. And that was really how I got interested in the subject. So I'm not an expert on typography at all. I'm just I'm a fan. And it was having these conversations with Stephen where he told me about these really amazing obsessive characters who are really concerned about things like the shape of particular letter forms and the shape of even the dots over I's and things like that. Also, just all the language of typography I love, you know, all that stuff about glyphs and swashes and the names of fonts from Aldus to Zap. So that's really, I'm really kind of interested in the stories behind typography and the kind of all the lingo around type is what fascinates me.
It's because of your book I actually wrote a poem and used the word tittle, which is, and can you explain to everybody what a tittle is?
Yeah, so a tittle is the name for the dot over an I, and who even knew that it had a name, but it does.
That's
yeah,
how,
and
like,
and there can be different
that,
shapes,
yeah.
You know, they can be round or they can be square or they can be, in my novel Death of a Typographer, there's a particular plot point which turns on the shape of a tittle.
Punctuation for me also, I think, imbues personality as much as, you know, fonts for you or your friend, Stephen. So to me, that's why I find them fascinating. That's why I love the semicolon. It's my favorite punctuation mark. And I know it's quite one of those controversial punctuation marks. Lots of people hate it and think it's like just unwieldy and irrelevant. But to me, I find it a lovely punctuation mark because it just marks that there is more to come. You know, I find that full stop really brutal and final, but the semicolon is just like, okay, well, you know, there's more coming.
Right.
So it's just that anticipation. I'll read out Half Wink now. And the reason why the poem is called Half Wink is because if you actually look at a semicolon, it actually does look like a half wink. And so, you know, it's not just me just being whimsical for no reason at all. It actually does look like a half wink. Half wink. You had me when I saw that semicolon, gentle half wink. A pause, but then that finger curl, cheekiness and intent. Anyone can place a comma, a little trip, a crease in the smooth, but that mark right there made me stumble. A leveling, a balance, speaks of the measure of us. You had me, you really did. Now, that last line that no one can actually see because we're talking, but that last line actually has a semicolon in it. And so my poetry is you have to actually read it because there are a lot of little small things like that that you'll miss out in just actual reading.
People need to buy the book and then they will see all the punctuation. But let me ask you about the book as a whole. So Turbulence, your collection, is divided into four sections.
Yeah.
They're called Wreckage, Chimera, Fish and Turbulence. So can you tell us a bit about each section and give us an overview of how it all fits together?
Yeah, Turbulence, as its name suggests, is just about the turmoil of life. It was written during a very, very difficult period of my life. So the first section is all about the aftermath of my long-term marriage, the immediate sort of reaction. The second part is about a short fling that I had with a man who inspired a lot of poetry. And even when the relationship went bust, I still continued to write. So he was the spark, really. Third part's called Fish, and it's really about online dating. So pretty much everything, all the experiences I had. And the last section, Turbulence, is really just about the turbulence of life. So losses, sort of things that just trip you up. And it's the whole collection on the whole is just, I think, about change and transformation and just dealing with it and trying to do it as gracefully as you can. It doesn't always work, but, you know, there's a lot of pain there. But I try to inject as much beauty in the images as I can.
And it's quite a playful collection as well, I think. You have quite a playful approach to language. And although you're dealing with some quite difficult subject matter, you do it in a way which is very readable and enjoyable and often funny.
Yeah, I think so. I really don't like reading misery memoirs, you know, when there's just so much grief and so much anger and darkness. It's very, very hard to read. I know that as a critic that I find that incredibly hard to read sometimes. So even though there's darkness in my collection, I also wanted to balance it with a sense of playfulness. So the reader can read about the pain, but do it in a way that doesn't sort of hurt them emotionally in some ways. You know, there is like, there's an appreciation of the language as well. It's not just emotion. But let's get back to your book for a bit though, Nick. Your book is also lovely to look at. So those people who haven't got it yet, because you have to tell us about the fact that each section is written, well, the headings of each section is in a different font. Now, why did you do that, you and Stephen?
Death of a Typographer has 26 chapters. That number's not accidental. For each chapter title, we used a different font. So I asked Stephen, who's the designer of the book, to pick out a different font. And he's chosen, and they're all listed at the back for people who are type fans. And they go from Accidens Grotesque, which is chapter one, through to there are well-known fonts like Caslon and Helvetica and Cooper Black in there, and also some less well-known ones like there's something called Bodidleone Stencil and Graveblade and Motta Ombra. So there's a lot of different fonts that we've used there, and they all reflect the story in some way. So fonts and type are very important in this story, and so I thought it was important that we had a lot of different fonts on display in the book. Although the text of the book, I must say, is all set in one font. We thought it would be asking a bit much to expect readers to jump about from one font to the next in the actual reading of the text. So all of that is beautifully set in a font called Mercury Text, which was actually something that we had to buy in specially from a type foundry in the United States. But yes, it is, I think, a beautifully designed book by Stephen. And yes, I'm really, really happy with the way that it looks. But none of these fonts are accidental. They all reflect something about
the story.
They're
all deliberate.
Yeah.
Nick, do you have a favourite font yourself? Because I know people get very attached to fonts. The ones that, even just writing a simple document, people tend to use the same font over and over and over again. Like, you know, some people are obsessive about pencils or pens or lining their desks a certain manner. I know I always use the same font. I feel weird if I see another font. I have to sort of convert it to my favourite font. And I think a lot of people do this without realising. So yes, what is your favourite? What's your favourite font and what's your favourite punctuation, actually?
When I'm working on the just on a laptop, I'm a bit boring. I do tend to just use Times, I'm afraid. But when I'm reading, I do like to read in fonts like Garamond and Bembo, which are those... which are versions of the classic Renaissance fonts, and those are the kind of fonts that I grew up reading. So, you know, literature feels to me as if it should be in fonts like that. But for this book, Mercury, we've used a more modern font, but it is still a serif font, and it does still have that kind of quite classic kind of literary kind of look. But for another font that I really love is a display font, which is called Peignot, and we use that for one of the chapter titles in the book, and it's a mid-20th century French font, and it's a display font. You know, they used it in advertising and things like that. You wouldn't set a book in it, but it's just really stylish, and it really evokes that kind of mid-20th century world of glamour and style. And one thing that really fascinates me about fonts is the way they do have these kind of emotional and psychological registers to them. They have an effect on us, whether we know it or not.
I know, we sort of go around looking at fonts all the time. They're wallpaper, but we don't even realise it. All those billboards that we look at, you know, when we walk around, and just stencils on vans, they're everywhere.
Yeah. Yeah. That's right. A stencil font sort of suggests that something is kind of cheap and cheerful, whereas a sort of tall, slim font with kind of really sharp serifs, like they would use on a stylish magazine, suggests, you know, elegance and style and luxury. Whereas something like Helvetica, for example, is a very kind of plain modernist font that they would use in hospitals and airports. And that's kind of really neutral or intended to be neutral. So they all have a kind of effect on us. They have kind of hidden meanings.
Yeah, subliminal sometimes. You don't realise it, do you?
No, you don't. But it's kind of having an effect on us all the time.
Can you tell us more about your lead character, Martin? And he's one of those, you know, font-obsessive men who travels a different way if he comes across typography that offends his eye. He has a headache, doesn't he?
Yeah, so Martin Kern is my protagonist, and he's a designer, and he has a special sensitivity to fonts, and he uses his sensitivity to solve crimes, type-related crimes. And his co-investigator is Lucy Tan, and she's a journalist, and the two of them are investigating a series of type-related murders, and all the trails lead back to an elusive designer called Peter van Vleugstraeten, who's a Dutch type genius who disappeared in the 1970s, and he's been roaming the world trying to create the world's most perfect, most beautiful font, which he hides in secret places around the world. So Martin and Lucy are on this mission to find out how, or if at all, the murders are connected to Vleugstraeten and his secret font. So as you can tell, I'm being quite playful. It's quite tongue-in-cheek, but there is the plot there is all to do with fonts and people who are very obsessive about fonts. And there really are people like that. You know, in the research for this book, I came across some really fascinating people. And there was a French guy called, he had the marvelous name of Maximilian Vox. And a quote of his is, "My only love is printed paper. I eat it, I drink it, I dream of it." And there really are people like that. So when you think there are people like that, then the idea of this guy who gets a migraine every time he sees a font that he disapproves of is really not so unlikely at all.
Can you actually just read us a small section?
Yeah, so this is from a scene where Martin and Lucy, my two investigators, go to visit Monty Vergola, and Monty Vergola is a private type investigator, and they're keen to ask Monty to help them to solve the case. How's business, Martin said. Busier than ever, Monty said. I've never known the streets so thick with criminal types. Letters so ugly they'd make your eyes bleed. Monty shook her head with a sigh at the depravity of humanity. But what can I do for you two lovely people? Martin said, we need you to find a font. Monty frowned. A simple missing font case? That's bread and butter work. Any number of two-bit type shoes out there could help you with that. You don't need me. Martin gripped her arm. We need the best, Monty. At least hear me out, then decide if you'll take the case. Okay, okay, since it's you. What you got? Martin put his hand in his pocket and held out the piece of type from Cremington's shop. Monty took it, gave it a cursory glance and then a closer look. She spun her chair around, reached for a jeweler's magnifying glass, which she screwed into her eye, then bent over to inspect the type. She sat up slowly with a long, low whistle. Holy Joanna, is this what I think it is? Martin nodded. Where did you find this baby? Monty said. In Tom Cremington's workshop. I heard about Cremo. It's a damn shame. Monty shook her head in wonder. But I never suspected this. I gotta hand it to you, Kern. It's not every day someone walks into my office with a piece of Flugstratton's secret font. So there you go. Thank So they've got a piece of Flugstratton's secret font, and as the novel goes on, we find out, you know, how the secret font is connected to the murders. But
it's lovely too, because there's so many puns in there for word nerds to basically indulge in and love. That's what I love about it. It's such a romp of a read. It's fun. You know, not many murder mysteries are fun to read, but yours was.
Well, thank you, Tweet. Look, I did want to write a book that would be fun and entertaining and that people would enjoy reading. And people do seem to have enjoyed it so far. And I think we could all do with, you know, something that is a bit, you know, light and enjoyable, you know, in these times. But let me ask you another question about your work. Now, the world of dating is important to you. And it's the dating scene is something that you look at with a very skeptical, even scathing eye. There's a poem called Dating as Hell, which needs no explanation, and another one called Dating as Slush Pile. And one of my favorite lines in your whole book is, not those bumbling knaves. I just think the word knaves is not used nearly enough these days.
I don't think anyone has ever used it recently. I have no idea why I even used it, really. So maybe I've just sort of, you know,
Exactly the right word. So do you think how does it help to process all of these terrible dates that you describe in these poems? How does it help to write poems about them, do you think?
Turbulence is very much, when I was writing it, Nick, it was basically a poetic diary. And so sometimes when I would have terrible dates or experiences with men that I really couldn't compute or process at the time, I thought, look, I'm going to write a poem about it. And it sort of helped me that way. So yeah, there's a lot of online dating poems in this collection. It makes up a quarter of the book, because I don't really think there's all that much about it in poetic form. I mean, there's lots of feature articles and books about dating, but this is like 21st century, we're all doing it, but I couldn't really see anything out there poetically about dating, so I thought, okay, right, I'm going to have to do it myself.
Well, I do really like the way that you, your poetry is very contemporary. I mean, it's very much about this 21st century online dating. You mentioned people like Anthony Bourdain. But on the other hand, there are also lots of classical allusions as well. Like you mentioned Sisyphus, Eurydice, and Pegasus. What's your relationship to the classics? You're obviously quite keen on the classical world.
I think I just wanted a meld of old and new, really. You know, then people who read it don't necessarily need to know who these people, mythical references are, but other people who read it may pick up on it. So each poem, I'm trying to make it sort of layered. So there's just the immediate meaning. You can enjoy it for the imagery or other sort of literary references and just for simple motion. So that's why I think there's sometimes this slightly, and also there are references to different words in different languages. So there are references to Japanese words and German words and Italian words and French throughout Turbulence as well. And sometimes all you see is just the title itself is like a Japanese word. And if you don't know it, this is what I mean by layered meaning, Nick. If you don't know why I call the poem a certain thing because it's in a different language, there's your cue to go away and look. And if you look out for this certain word, you'll see why it relates to the poem. So it's basically a little homework for the reader. So, a poem is not that easy. People think, poems, it's 14 lines. I can knock it off in like one reading and I know exactly what you're talking to. No, not with my poetry, because it's not Instagram poetry, which is all very, I find Instagram poetry quite fluffy and sort of like fortune cookie light. My poetry is not like that. You can sort of understand it, but there are layers to it. And I sometimes do sort of give the reader homework. We don't know a certain word in French or Japanese. You wonder why I named a certain poem that way. It's there for a reason. Everything is very, very, very deliberate in a poem. You have very few words to play with. So every single word from the title down is important. So I put it there for a purpose. I'm not just putting a title there for no reason. There's a reason why it's called a certain thing.
Do you want to read another one?
Yeah, I'm going to read out Triple Word Score.
Scrabble reference there.
It's the Scrabble reference, of course, but there's also another reference in there as well. So that's what I mean. They're sort of layered. So I'm going to just hang on until I find the poem. So, yeah, Triple Word Score. Airily, that word you put down, a triple word score that won over me. What else could I do in defeat but bestow a kiss? Willingly. That hand that led you over to the bed already crumpled in weight of more play, twister without a spinner. Hesitantly, cues that were to be read in semi-darkness, but I can't see the widening of your pupils when touch went there and there. Brazenly, guess and feather points anyway, alternate with firmer grip and pause and change and move, repeat, into, stop, over, around, under, through, a tangle of nouns and prepositions. So, yeah, that's what I mean by being playful with words. It's all very, this poem is not explicit, it's more suggestive.
Yes, well, anyone who remembers learning grammar at school may think that, language is a boring subject, but you've certainly made it pretty sexy in a lot of your poems.
Remember what we said right at the beginning? I want to make language sexy again. And this is my way of doing it.
Absolutely.
Through words. Through words and punctuation themselves, nothing else. There's no visual imagery. You can't see anything. You're going to have to imagine it in your mind's eye. And that's exactly what I want to do with this collection.
Now, a lot of people who know your name probably know you as a critic and a reviewer of books and theatre for a lot of publications. So it was quite brave, I think, to make the leap into writing and publishing poetry yourself. So how did that come about? Have you always been a secret scribbler, or was it something that you've just started doing? How do you feel about making that transition from reviewer to writer?
I first wrote poetry probably about 15, 20 years ago, sort of very casually. I didn't really think much of it. A couple of poems were published and I sort of left it aside. And for the next two decades or so, I was too busy writing about other people's words. So I was, I still am a literary reviewer and arts critic. So I would interview other writers. I would do features on them. I'd do all sorts of things, but if there's other people's books. And so my own creative voice was, lost, I guess, submerged. And I never really missed it until, as I said earlier, until my marriage broke down. And all of a sudden, I turned to something that appealed to me decades prior, and it helped. So it's basically cheaper than therapy for me, poetry. I don't drink, so I couldn't even turn to alcohol to numb the pain. So I basically did what lots of writers do. I started writing. And once I started writing, I couldn't stop. So it was almost like an organic process. I didn't set out to write a book. It just happened that way. I just had too many poems and I thought, I think other people might enjoy this, other people whose lives are beset with turmoil and turbulence who are unhappy, who have left marriages or who have started dating, they want to know what it's like. So that's, I think that was a progression, Nick. But your book is the second book. How, what's the difference between the first and the second? Have you learned things between the two?
Yes. Well, my first book, Ghost Lines, came out more than 10 years ago. So there was an 11-year gap between them. And I was writing in all that time. But the first one was probably a bit more of a conventional crime novel, although it was never completely conventional. The first book did also, as the title suggests, there were some ghosts in it. And I was playing around with genre a bit in that first novel, Ghost Lines. But in this new novel, Death of a Typographer, it's much more playful in terms of genre. The excerpt I read earlier, you could tell I was sort of, it was a little bit of a homage, a little bit of a pastiche to sort of noir crime writing. And in other parts of the book, I write in different styles, and there's a mock documentary in there. There's a mock Wikipedia page. So I think, and there's lots of jokes. There's lots of, you know, things which are, in, you know, funny, hopefully. And, you know, interspersed with more serious kind of literary writing as well. So it's a multi-generic kind of novel.
It's very hard to describe.
Yes, and that was a bit of a problem when I tried to find a publisher for it, because, you know, the publishers would say, well, what is this? Is it crime? Is it humour? Is it literary? And I'd say, well, you know, it's all of those things, you know, and more, which kind of makes it a bit difficult to market, you know. But I guess what
that's the best thing about it, though, Nick, the fact that it's completely unique. There is nothing out there. That's why I love this book so much, your book. I have never read a book like this before. And I've, you know, I told you, reviewed 20 years worth of reviewing. I have never read a book like Death of a Typographer before. I've read so many crime fiction books, several like funny, humorous books, but never a book about fonts as a narrative or fonts as character base or anything like that. So it was absolutely mind-boggling to read something like this. I loved it from the start.
Well,
I think because I'm a word nerd, how can I not love it?
Because you're a word nerd, yes. Yeah. And I think both of our books would certainly appeal to word nerds. And you asked me before, what did I learn between the first book and the second book? And I think probably what I learned was, you know, write the thing that you really want to write. You know, because if I'd listened to, I suppose, publishers or people who were saying a particular type of writing, you need to write what's fashionable, you need to write what's popular, you need to write in a particular genre and don't deviate from that genre, well, I would not have been happy or particularly successful doing that. I had to write the book that I wanted to write, even though that didn't really fit into any genre, and even though it was, you know, people weren't able to categorize it very easily. But in the end, that was the book that I wanted to write, and I just wrote it for my own amusement. I had no idea if it was going to get published or not. I wrote it to please myself, and now I'm completely happy that it's out there, and other readers like you, Twee, seem to be enjoying it.
I think that's the best advice I can give someone, really. Just write what you want to write. Forget about everything else. Forget about the market. Forget about the, you know, wannabe or prospective reader. If you're not enjoying what you're writing, it's going to be a terrible book regardless. So don't be cynical and think, okay, I'm going to write the next best thing or the big Australian novel. It's not going to work because your heart won't be in it. And really, if you write a book, your heart has to be in it, because it's such a long process, you know, for completion and publication. If you're lucky to get published in the first place, and you have to love this work, really, you really do.
Talking about the heart, Twee, so you have a daughter, and one of the most moving poems in your collection, Turbulence, is directed to your daughter, and it's titled For Ava. Would you like to say a bit about that poem and maybe read it for us?
Yeah, well, Lodestar to Ava is right at the beginning of Turbulence, and it's obviously in the section where my marriage had just dissolved and I was just in absolute dazed, not knowing how to deal with reality post-marriage, really. So this poem is one of two directed to my daughter, who's now 12. So I wrote it to her, and it's fairly explanatory. It's just, I think, just expresses my love for her and my confusion about what's happening, and a reminder to me and to her that, you know, whatever happens, we're together, we're still a unit. We may not sort of be a happy sort of enormous nuclear unit of three, but know, three has basically become two. I'll read it now. Lodestar to Ava. Your mother is an in-betweener in transitional mode. From what is to what will be. Over-the-shoulder glance, spoiled. A throat-scorching landscape. For the love of you, I tried to make the triangle prevail until enough I could prop no more. A collapse of this formation of sticks, stones that did hurt, a soul in unfashionable black. Shield your eyes, darling girl. I don't know what will become of us. Looking forward, a dazzle, for this tiny binary unit is all I can write for. Those who spark, then fade, will make their presence felt. But you, you are the lodestar to light me out, a reminder of a life to be kissed. I could have written, you know, pages and pages in a book about how much I love my daughter, but instead I've written a poem. It says exactly the same thing.
I think your work is economical, but it does touch on these really big themes, you know, of loss and heartbreak and parenting and the title poem, of course, Turbulence. It raises things that all readers, I think, can relate to, but it does it very economically and with great wit and lightness and great readability. You know, there's some modern poetry out there which is hard to read, and yours is certainly readable, but it does have these layers of depth, as we were saying before.
I really tried hard to make it as readable as I can without sort of sacrificing the beauty and the layers, but I really wanted people who read books, not necessarily poetry, but books, to read Turbulence and go, yeah, I've never read poetry before, but hey, I understand what she's talking about.
I think readers will, and I think I certainly hope that readers buy it in great numbers.
So, all right, tell me about your next book, Nick.
So I'm working on a non-fiction book called Melbourne Circle, Melbourne Circle Walking with Memory. Hang on, no, let me get the title right. I'm working on the book called Melbourne Circle, Walking, Memory and Loss, which is about a walk that my partner Lynn and I took around the whole city of Melbourne a few years ago, walking through the suburbs. It's an exercise in psychogeography, and which is about looking for parts of the city that are lost, secret, little known, and trying to uncover the lost secrets of the city, and doing so not as historians, not as experts, but just as walkers. So it's about that, and it's also a memoir about my life with Lynn, who passed away in 2018. So it's also about personal loss. It's a book about grief and memory on a personal level, as well as about memory in the city. So that will be coming out hopefully later this year. And what about you? Are you working on more poems?
Yes, I am. I've just started a new collection, but not that many poems in. I think I've written about 8 poems. But, you know, that's a start. Hopefully there will be another collection. I don't know when. Whenever.
So people should support their local bookshops by getting online and buying your book, Turbulence, by Twee On.
Yes, and yours too, Nick Gadd, Death of a Typographer. Get to it, people.
Twee, it's been lovely chatting to you.
And to you, Nick.
And okay, goodbye, everybody. Thanks for listening to this podcast.
Bye, everyone.
You've been listening to The First Time Podcast. The First Time Podcast is produced by Phoebe 80 and supported by Writers Victoria, the ACT Writers Centre, and our wonderful patrons.